At banjo workshop, you mumbled through that something awful.
No.
Couldn't be heard.
Good heaven, save the pieces.
What?
Save the pieces.
These are meant to be thrown around a little bit, yeah.
Thrown around.
Well, you know, when you take this equipment out, it's meant to be.
Well, now, are you Dave or Doug?
I'm David.
David.
Yeah, David is. Yeah, the British tend to sort of keep their, you know, whole names, you know, and whereas
they don't
abbreviate them.
Okay. I had a son, David.
Oh, you did.
We say David.
What was that guy's name? He was David Langdon Smith or something like that.
Langdon Smith or Langwell Smith. You're close, yeah.
Anyway, it was from Hartford. Hartford is Hartford.
That's who you are. You're from Wales and you're Dolly.
It's Hartford because we got a breed of cattle known as Hartford.
Okay, just one thing. If you could just drop the cord and up.
That's right.
That's fine.
Why drop it?
Well, because if you do it out there, what we will hear is we'll hear you saying something, and then we'll hear.
Oh, it moves around in there like that.
Well, yeah, it's a microphone. It's sensitive to vibrations of all kinds. So,
In other words, if a roach runs across here, we'll get it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Good thought.
what I wanted to do with this, and we've already started recording, so that's fine. I wanted to, get, some idea of your life and some notion of where you learned your music and how you learned your music.
Oh, my God.
Where were you born, Frank?
I was born in Bluefield, West Virginia.
And when was that?
That was October the 6th, 1928.
Now, he wasn't born at home, like, or in a cave, like he'd like for people to think, either. He was born in hospital. And yeah, I'd known him at least 5 years before I realized that he never did live in a house without indoor plumbing. And I did, you know.
Oh, I have, but not home.
tell me about your family. Who are your family?
Well, it was just, I'm the only child, dad and mother, and they were pretty old. They had me late when I was 36, I believe.
Yeah,
37. Anyway. It sounded like the last chance or something, And it was a very rural situation out in the wood. Although it's in town, it's in a corporation, it was very wild situation. And we had garden and fruit trees and all the things, to do with. Couldn't make a living there, of course, on a small patch, but during the Depression we did become almost self-sufficient. My dad was a carpenter and joiner by trade, and work was very hard to find. And my mother was a RN, registered nurse. She managed to get a job with the WPA. I hope they know what that is, and carried us through. And my grandmother died. My father's mother died in 1936, and my grandfather came to live with us. I would have been going on 8. And prior to that, I had already learned to play a few tunes on a homemade banjo my father made because of visiting with Grandpa and, back and forth. So I actually started playing tunes on the banjo at about 7. But when he came to live with us, then he started sawing on the fiddle too. He played fiddle and banjo and was a good dancer. I never did learn to dance. And I got interested in the fiddle, so he really got me started on how to tune it and how to hold it. And I even had a small homemade fiddle, but it was almost nothing more than a toy. So, that was sort of a beginning stage, and then I very quickly jumped on the standard size, It was a little big, but I was about 9 and I could hold it, man. So that's really how I got started. Now, Grandpa was a much better banjo picker than he was a fiddler. And along about the same time, there was this old fella named Jim Farthing, who was from Northern Virginia.
When would this be? This would be during the 1930s, were you talking?
Yeah, mid-30s.
Mid-30s.
I got to know him because he worked with my dad, as a carpenter. They worked on construction like coal tipples, company stores, company houses, individual homes, theaters, all kind of buildings where the It was either frame or inside carpenter work, you know. And he was a fiddler, and he was a good one. And I thought, you know, this sounds good, so I'll just try to learn his tune, you know, his way. So when I play, you're really hearing more of Jim Fartley and Yarmouth Grandfather, except for certain tunes. Because I was determined to copy him, you see. Of course, nobody can really copy anybody perfectly. So anyway, I sound like him, according to people who've heard both of us. You know.
What else do you know about him? Do you know where he learned to play?
Farthing? Yeah. He was from he was from between Alta Vista and Danville, Virginia, which is Pennsylvania County. And he came up in my part of the country when he was about 15 years old. Well, he'd already got some basic tunes. He played a banjo as well. His father played a banjo, old man Jim Varty. And he was already familiar with how to hold a fiddle and play a few tunes. And he married fairly young. And his father-in-law was an excellent fiddler, a man, Charlie Hawley. And this was the beginning of his repertoire as a fiddler. You know, I call him a master fiddler, you see. So what I learned from him was from Charlie Hawley, but not totally, you see. And Charlie Hawley had learned from two old men way back by the name of Newt Crockett and a man named Gillespie. And undoubtedly others I don't know about, you see. So it goes way on back in a line. And so Jim Fartley, my grandfather died in 1944, so I would only been about 16. And Jim Farthing lived to 1962. So, of course, I was gone, you know, to school, gone to the service, and away some, but other than that, I tried to get with him as much as possible. And that's sometimes hard to do because he was a moody, temperamental type person, you know. Sometimes it was a fruitless visit, you know. Mm-hmm. So basically, to make a long story short, which we didn't, Grandpa got me started, and Jim Farthing was the, what you might call a mentor.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you went out to see Jim, you know, did you sort of go out with a plan in mind, I want to learn a certain fiddle tune today, or you just went out and visited with him?
No plans, you know, just go see him and see if he'd play some tunes, you know. And invariably get another one or two, you know, a couple of three new ones every time. Mm-hmm. There was no end to it, you see, his tunes, as far as I could tell. I'm certain he knew 100 tunes. He might have known more than that. Probably knew 140 or 50 tunes.
I heard you say he took a lot of them to his grave with him.
Oh, sure.
But nobody knows.
We didn't have any way to record, you see. We didn't know. I'd heard of a wire recorder, but you couldn't get one, you know, so it's a shame that he wasn't recorded.
So
that happened lots of times.
Oh, yeah. So how did you learn, you listened to him play something, and then you went home and you practiced really hard, right?
Yeah, hum it and whistle it for a day or two, maybe. You get it in your head, you see. And then play it as simply as you could, I mean, the best you could, and then keep trying to embellish it a little bit, you know, make it sound better, fancy it up, but don't overdo it, you know. You can ruin a tune by trying to overdo it, over-decorate it.
But it may turn out a little bit different from the way that he did.
Oh, I'm sure I play a little bit different than he did, yeah.
And what about your father? Did your father play music as well?
He played fiddle and banjo, not very well. He didn't have a great number of tunes, but you couldn't get him to play, unless we were alone. I mean, right around the house, you know, if somebody came, he immediately put the fiddler banjo up, he's afraid somebody would hear him. I don't know why that is, but even like that, they think, well, I'm not very good, you know, and I don't want somebody hearing it. Maybe whoever was hearing him would know middle C for my train whistle, so what
do you think? You do hear your dad record playing one tune, don't you?
Dave said I did, but I don't think so.
I heard it one time. I don't know where it is now, but I remember it.
Well, if it is, I don't know where it is.
Anyway, it was a little bit of your dad fiddling and you playing. You ought to tell David about the. I thought it was a great moment, and I'm sure it was for him. When you said you started playing with them, playing a tune with them one evening on your little banjo. for somebody's on that little banjo. Yeah.
What was that story?
Oh, let's see. We were sitting there and my dad had the harmonica. Grandpa had the fiddle. I had the little homemade banjo. I still have it, by the way. And if I remember right, I all of a sudden just started playing Sourwood Mountain. They were playing it. I just started playing it. I'd never played before.
And you can imagine what they thought and felt. I said to him, what?
I guess you'd call it a happening.
I said to him, what did your dad or your granddad say? He said, well, Grandpa, or somebody said, well, what have we here, you know, or something like that.
What do you attribute that to? Why do you think that happened?
Lord, I don't know. It was an event.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, Grandpa said something like he might amount to something after all. Boy, if he knew.
Well, what about your mother? Was she?
Mother wasn't very musical. She had a fine old piano. Well, those great big upright things, you know. Made about 1872. It's still down home. She played some by music. She had to have the music up here, you know. And she played rather mechanical. But she played a good bit of music. Not just hymns, other kind of music. But it wasn't a natural thing. It wasn't inherent. You take the music away and, you know, she was lost. Cool mechanical. A lot of people like that.
But then your mother's side had a little music.
A little bit.
Your grandmother.
Yeah, grandmother played harmonica and jew's harp till she lost her teeth and she couldn't play jew's harp. Because, well, it's hard to play harmonica with one old teeth.
And Uncle Rufus could play, he had the rhythm.
Luella played a guitar, but it wasn't a very musical family. They sang hymns around the piano, but it was nearly always with the music. And the singers either knew it or maybe knew a little bit about music. But it was more or less hymn book or song book oriented, you know. A Sunday evening gathering or something like that. It wasn't really a dance music situation, you know. They went to dances, but this was down in Tennessee, but somebody else, old man Rice Bumgardner, and somebody had to play the music, you know. It wasn't in the family.
Tell me a little bit about your early years. Did you go to school?
Oh, yeah. I went to public school. Started in the first grade in a two-room schoolhouse, not a one-room.
Where was that? That was in Bluefield?
That was in Bluefield, yeah, Little White Thorn School. There used to be a song we had. One part of it was, how we love the Little White Thorn School. Of course, us kids, how we hate the Little White Thorn School. That was the first three grades. Then I went to a place called Fairview, and that was fourth through ninth, and 3 years of high school. It used to be four, but they cut it off some way at ninth, I suppose, trying to get you started in high school in 10. Maybe you'd finish the other three yesterday. Freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior. I went to college after the service on a GI Bill. I have a degree in college, a bachelor's degree. No music in it anywhere. In fact, there's a funny story there. There was a policy at the college that if you could play an instrument, you didn't have to take music. But if you played an instrument, you could play before this head of the music department and get, I think it was 2 hours credit. Just, you know, it was just an extra thing. You'd done that much, not necessarily in the school. So I took the pipes over, played two or three tunes, you know, and I didn't get my credit. And the reason was it wasn't a musical instrument.
And you played all kinds of things at Concord for people. But they wouldn't give him credit for it.
Oh, I'd play for dances or parades. You know, some of the sororities or, fraternities would have a deal, maybe a ball game halftime or a parade, a prep rally, and I'd play. But anyway, this was not a musical instrument, so I didn't get my credit in college. That's one of the best stories I know of.
Which was the college?
That was Concord College in Mercer County, West Virginia. It's Athens, West Virginia, a small town. It was a normal school to start with, and of course it got bigger and branched out into different degrees of...
It's a state teacher's college now.
Basically, yeah. I took to teach teachers, basically.
What was your bachelor's degree in?
Biology. Yeah, that was a major, and I had several minors. I had a minor in geography and history and psychology. Kept throwing them in.
Why did you decide on biology? Was it something you'd done?
I kind of liked botany and zoology. I grew up in the woods, and I was always fascinated by flowers and trees and birds and reptiles and mammals, you know, and fish occasionally, not too many streams down there, but I was always fascinated with the outdoors, you know, mushrooms. And
people don't know that.
Just a kind of a natural interest, you know.
No
particular reason for that field. I just didn't want to be an engineer or
teacher
or literary or social sciences. Or, what was it Dr. Simpson called it? Those of you in something know you won't make any money.
I forget what he said.
Humanities. That
humanities.
In the humanities.
That's the word in the 60s.
That's the kind of thing I would have immediately dropped out of college, you know. And the paperwork, I couldn't stand those papers, you know. You have to do a term paper. Oh, God, that was just like a death sentence, you know. Or you have to write a thesis. Oh, my God. It's a terrible infliction of pain and suffering, yeah.
Now, were you playing music all through this time while you were in
school? Well, intermittently. See, it hasn't been a constant thing because being away to school, away on a job, or away in the service, or, you know, out west on a big rip-roaring trip or something. And
on the other hand.
But it was fairly enough to where I get way out of practice, you know.
It's pretty consistent,
Not much. It was hard to find instruments in the service.
I'm talking about the bagpipes in Germany.
Well, that's the only thing I played. Yeah. So there was a couple of years I really lost out on the fiddle somewhat, but I got back into it, you know. It's not like Ernie Carpenter, he was off for 25 years or something, you know. And it took him a while to get back in the swing, because he's playing better now than he did a few years ago. Anybody will tell you that.
Frank used to pipe his group to the mess hall and back and things like that, you know, in Germany.
When did you learn the bagpipes?
Well, I got interested in them as a teenager, but there was no help and no information and no teachers. And I had to get some books and kind of start from scratch. And then when I went to service, got to Germany, the British Army on the Rhine, B-A-O-R, was nearby. They were downriver from us, the Rhine, you know. We had this sector, and they were up northern part. I'd go over there and hang around with them a lot. The 10th Highland Light Infantry, for instance, was there. I think we were attached to the 8th Army, I'm not sure. They seemed to tolerate me. Then I got to leave one time. I got a furlough and flew to Prestwick. Got a hop. You see, if you had your pass papers, and there was a military plane going somewhere, and they had an empty seat, you could ride on that plane. So I rode from Frankfurt or Rhein-Main or Wiesbaden, see, I don't know, whatever airport's close to, well, there's two of them, and one of the airports close to Frankfurt. Got a hop to Prestwick. So I got off there and got on a bus, went up to Kilmarnock and up to Glasgow, and hopped around, went to Edinburgh, and I bicycled around over mile and mile. You know, went to Bobby Burns' country, Ayrshire, and out to Largs and Greenock and Paisley, and I went up north as far as
Fort William.
On the west and up the east. Didn't quite make it to Dundee. Got up in close to Dundee. But I wound up at Stirling. You know, Argyll and Sutherland were quartered there, which they still are. So I just spent, I must have spent 2 weeks or more with them there, the pipe band, you see. I don't know why they took me in. I stayed there, see. I got room and board at Stirling Castle.
You walked in and said, here I am, you know.
No, I did not. I made friends with the pipe sergeant and then the pipe major and the boys were there. So I just, when they had a class on bag seasoning, I went to it, a class on reed setting and tuning and maintenance of the stocks and setting your channel reed and tuning the instrument and controlling your pressure. And I'd already done some of that. I was already familiar with reeds, you see, and tune the tuning up, and I got a few pointers. So I'd sit in, we'd go around this table and practice chanting. Of course, they had the books. That was very hard on me, written music, you know. But anyway, I sat in on it and got a lot of good basic stuff. Learned the tune on a practice chanter. And then, of course, I had to go back, and I was off of it for several months. And I came back home and started on it again.
Are you still playing pipes?
Yeah, I can, once in a while. I have a small little parlor set. I can play pretty good. The big set, I'm having problems because I can't get reeds to fit. And I had this eye operation, so I wasn't supposed to handle a full set, and I've laid off of it a while, see. But I can play the little miniatures, the little parlor set yet. They're not too hard. Well, they're hard to control, but it's not the same as the full set. I was a member of the band here for some years. See, there's a pipe band here now, West Virginia Highlanders, American Legion sponsored. And I was asked to be a member, and I joined them back in 60... What? 60?
I don't remember.
Late 60s, and I was in it, what, maybe five years or something.
Mm-hmm.
Then being so far away, 180 miles away, and I couldn't come to practices, and I made maybe three parades a year, so I sort of dropped out of it. Those sort of things have a big turnover anyway, you know. If I lived close by, I'd be different.
Now, let me just try and get the history right. You were in the service, then you went to college on the GI Bill.
Right.
Got your degree in biology.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do then when you got out of college?
I retired. Wouldn't that be accurate?
He's been telling me that he retired at 24, so I suppose that...
I retired when I was 24 years old.
He didn't do any particular thing. He did several small jobs.
I did take them. See, my profession, if you call it such, was a surveyor, civil engineer. But I wasn't licensed to do that. I learned by apprenticeship and working with it. I took two or three tests. I actually tried to get a job with...
DNR.
The Department of Natural Resources, the Parks Service, and... Some kind of a biologist for the state,
right.
You know.
Marine biologist or something.
I was foolish enough to see these notices out in the courthouse, you know, wanted people for a job, and I was foolish enough to take these tests and then go for an interview or something, and most of the time I didn't hear anything. I just took the test and that was it. They didn't even send you a postcard and say you flunked or you passed or we're not going to hire you. You just never did hear any more about it. But to make a long story short, other than a few surveying jobs, I retired at the age of 24.
Was that, if I could say, sort of a philosophical decision, you know, I mean, something you
decided? Yeah, I'd always wanted to do that. And the job opportunities in this state have been zilch for all along, you know. Young people, all West Virginia young people do leave the state to work. It's like Ireland. You immigrate. Kind of a sad thing, because that's a pretty good natural resource.
Did you think of leaving to get a job?
No, I kind of figured I wouldn't do that. I did like the state well enough to stay. Like the climate, you know, and the trees. I'm not a city, I'm not a concrete asphalt person. I'd probably lose my mind in a big city. I'd rather go out and live in a cave or something. Or a squirrel's nest, you know, a tree or something. Haystack or something.
Even people who retire at 24 have got a few bills to pay. I mean,
I was living with my parents.
You never lived anywhere except on the hillside in Bluefield until
we were married. I was living at home with my parents, you see. Although I didn't... I didn't pay room and board. I didn't have to have money. You see, I kind of carried my own weight. And I kept the place up. I painted the roof, I painted the house, and I fixed the gutters and down and I mowed the yard, and I tried to take care of the garden and trees and trimmed the hedge. And, well.
Did you mow the yard?
Certainly, with a beer-powered mower.
Good heavens, we're going to change things to speed.
A beer-powered mower, remember those old...
Push mower.
Push mower.
Yeah.
And now I know my role. I'm the interpreter.
So that's about it. I just lived at home and did a lot of shooting, competitive shooting, and pistol and rifle matches.
Well, you played a lot of music in those years,
music,
too, didn't you?
Yeah, I played some music. And
Who were you playing with? Were you playing?
Just local people like the late John Hilt, who played the fiddle. We played the Tazewell Stock Market, for instance, almost every Monday for years.
Now, you were playing fiddle at this time?
No,
playing
banjo.
Banjo.
He was the fiddler.
Yeah.
And that's about all I can tell you about my checkered career.
You were playing around at civic groups and places where they ask you to, but that was, you know, occasionally. But
yeah,
now,
there's nothing steady about
Frank,
it, you know.
Frank, I'm sure he recognizes this fact, but hasn't said it, that the fact that he stayed at home, didn't have the responsibility of a family, and to have to get out and get a job and devote his time to something else, really gave him a chance to develop whatever practicing or studying he needed to do.
Yeah, I had a lot of time to put in on
music.
And
he certainly did absorb an awful lot of, by reading about, for instance, about pipes and history and all these things that go with it.
I've read everything I can find on the subject. But anyway, my dad wouldn't let me work. Like, for instance, I'd want to go help him finish a house or put a roof on a house or something or sign, you know. He didn't let me do very little work because he was afraid I'd hurt my hands. Saw a finger off or mash one up, and he didn't want me to do anything to interfere with fiddling, you see, or piping. He was very strict about that. So I didn't get to learn much as an apprentice, you see, or cabinet maker. A lot of people are like that. I've known several men that would not let their sons follow their trade, you see.
Did he get injured working? Did he?
Several times, but nothing real drastic. He'd be tied up, you know, like almost lose a finger in a drill or something, and he'd be out of action for a couple of weeks.
Did you want to do that? Did you want?
Well, when I was a kid, I was kind of interested in how you get this room built with all the corners 90 degrees and how you cut the rafters, things like that, you know. And I have a vague idea about it, but he would not let me actually get in there and work, other than maybe saw with a handsaw and nail up a bunch of stuff or maybe set a window. When it came to the machinery or the high climb or something, he refused to let me do it.
He must have had some kind of vision of how important the music that Frank played was going to be, because he really appreciated string music.
Well, you know, French Mitchell's father wouldn't let him work. He would not let him work.
He didn't even want him to injure his hands.
He said, you get to the house and start playing music, or, you know, something like that.
Take a job that is a supervisor job or an easy thing that you're not going to injure.
Yeah, which is unusual, because most people want you to get out and, you know, I mean, it's nice. You got to carry your own weight. They want to, especially the boys, you got to get out here, you know. And education's all right if it's got a practical side. They don't want you studying in humanities. They want you to learn how to be an automobile mechanic or a carpenter, a plumber, electrician, because this is a manner of making a living, you see.
What do you think about that? Do you think that's correct? Or?
Well, it's a good idea for most people who are not artistic, and it's nice to have something to fall back on in an emergency, you know, like if you're a welder. And you're not working, well, if something crashes, maybe you can get a job as a welder and survive, you see. I think that has its points to learn a trade or be able to, you know, handle a job, if the job there. That's the problem in West Virginia. There's no job. It's a problem all over the country. What kind of opportunity have you got? Grocery store? Oh, it'd always be demand for mechanics, you know. I don't think we've got many good ones. The man that can fix a carburetor is sitting behind a desk somewhere drawing $25,000 or $30,000 a year. He's not working on a carburetor. You're out here with one broke down and you're stuck. You got to get a new one.
me just change. When did you meet? When did you meet?
Oh, I met her at Cedar Lakes Art and Craft Fair, 1966. Is that right? July.
Sure, that's right. We're giving him a test here.
It's a wonder I can remember.
I keep thinking of the Bill Cosby Show, you know. They're always quizzing one another on the ready or some of these things.
Yeah, we got married in December of 69.
In our kilts.
Yeah,
really?
In our kilts.
Where did you get married?
In Norton, Virginia. We had gone down there to do a community program, and we had a dance group with us, and everybody was all costumed, and Frank was playing the pipes at night. It was very unusual, and we didn't plan it very far ahead of time, you know. We got down there, and we got a license and things. And... well, there's all kinds of little spin-off stories, but I'll just to put it so briefly. We did the program. It was an icy, snowy evening, and most of the people with us returned back to Putnam County, West Virginia, which is just south of Charleston, just west of Charleston. And we stayed overnight in Norton, but I remember that I had to gather up all these kilts and these swords and things. We borrowed a bunch of swords because the kids were doing sword dancing. And put them in the car, and what they had done was they had kept looking for us. You know, they attended our wedding, the dance group that we took down there with us, and so they made us this like they do at West Point, you know, the cross swords thing. And when we came out of church to go to the car, here we were with all that stuff, you know, and wrapped the bug, completely wrapped it up with toilet paper from that church bathrooms. I could have killed them. I've been trying to teach
them
conservation education, and here they wasted all that paper.
Yeah, kids will be kids. Well, not everybody gets married in a kilt.
I know when we got back, somebody said to me, well, tell me about it. And I described it. And you know, the woman that usually took the pictures, one of the mothers of the dance group, she had three kids in it. One of the kids was sick, and she wasn't along, and there wasn't any pictures taken at all. And so this girl said to me, when she asked me to describe it, she said, probably the most unique wedding in the history of America, and nobody took a picture.
Well, I kind of doubt that.
Well, that's what she said. I didn't say it.
Surely been a shotgun wedding somewhere more interesting than that.
So,
at any rate, my parents have since passed on, and we moved from that area to Rowan County.
Where my mother lives now.
Yeah.
That's where we live now.
Well, it's just one county below Larry. Larry, you know, picks a bench.
Yeah, we see a lot of Larry. He comes up there a little bit.
We lived in Monroe County, of course, 4 years, and then moved to Rome. She was agent in four different counties, Putnam.
I worked for University Extension. And
Putnam, Mercer, Monroe, and Rome.
Uh-huh.
That's where she got her dance group together, using the 4-H. She had square dance group and Morris dancing, Morris, English Morris, and rapper sword, and
did a lot of this
some Irish dancing,
stuff.
And
that
kind of thing, mm-hmm. based on the kids.
Many kids see. Involved in that kind
Young
of stuff.
People.
Of course, the reason we did it was extra. It wasn't part of the so-called standardized extension program, but Frank was there to accompany them, and we taught them history as well as how to dance. And they, you wouldn't believe the spin-offs from that.
They get interested in genealogy and history.
And
I've talked to a good many young people to play.
Oh, that's right.
Fiddle and banjos and things.
The Earth Circle Kaylee Band is absolutely an outgrowth of that. And they were all in the dance group except one. And then when we left Monroe County, they picked up instruments and formed a band.
The first chanter George Mulderose ever wrapped his fingers around was mine.
The first, yeah, and the first fiddle Don Dransfield ever held in his hands and played the scale was your fiddle.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just dwell on this point. About, yeah, do you think you've got some responsibility, you know, as a musician to, you know, pass on what you know to younger people?
That's the idea. Mm-hmm. That's what I've been trying to do.
How did this start? When did you start doing this? Or when did you become conscious of that?
Ooh, when did Miles Crasson start?
See, fiddling? you were doing that before I ever met you, Frank.
I'd say about 1960, I probably was getting some young...
visitors.
Young men, usually urban, northern urban people, interested in this type of fiddling. And banjo.
How did they find out about you?
Coming to festivals.
Frank started going to festivals.
Old Time Fiddlers Convention. Fairs, state fairs, county fairs. Things like that. Gatherings, clan gatherings. Various things where you might hear music on a local level. Regional music, folk music, however you say it.
And these people were mainly from where?
Gosh, all over. Chicago, Philadelphia. Pittsburgh.
New York City. John Burke.
New York.
And what's his name? The Sausage Fingers.
Yeah. New York
what
City.
Is it? Roger Sprung.
Well, he was already playing.
Oh, was he?
Well, okay. I didn't have him.
There were a lot of people that weren't. It came down.
A lot of people
to
were.
Gaylax, for instance.
Were trying to find something besides what was on the radio and on recordings like the bluegrass. And they'd suddenly realized, hey, there's something back here in the bushes, you know. Hey, this is old, you know. These people have never been heard outside the community or something. And once they get started, boy, do they dig, you know. They're dedicated. At any rate, I've got several of them going, you know.
These are people who haven't sort of grown up in the community. They've come from outside, you know. Were the people within the same community that, you know, came and visited and learned as well, or were mostly these people?
No, most of them would be outsiders. Now, I'd have a banjo student like Monty St. Clair, who was a local boy. But when you think about it, they're usually from way off somewhere.
The early ones were. You see, that was at the beginning of the revival of folk music and traditional life in America, in the years when it was just beginning. And most mm-hmm. of them were from outside, and an awful lot of them still are. But there are a lot of young West Virginia people who've been interested in traditional things too.
Yeah, now that Erd Ferkel Kelly band probably wouldn't exist if I hadn't lived in Monroe County.
Okay, tell me about this band.
And these young people got started, well, really with your dance group.
They were all but one of them were members of the dance group.
We were all in this one county, and I got some of them interested in music, you know. And after I left, lo and behold, we have a Kelly band formed. And they're pretty darn good, if I do say so myself. And, you know, I didn't teach the band, I just got them interested and kind of got the ball rolling. They mostly worked on theirself.
The fact of the matter is that they learned the tunes because they knew the tunes because they danced to them hundreds of times. Yeah. And so some of them were playing instruments and others picked them up when they found time.
I teach them two or three new ones every time I see them.
And then the next time
they're good learners.
Them, they're
yeah, they're good learners. It's quite a band. We all have some pictures of it.
They're good.
They're young people, and they play Appalachian music. They play a good bit of Irish. They play some Scottish. They even got a few Welsh things in their repertoire.
Mm-hmm. And they wear kilts.
Because most of them have their roots in the British Isles, if you want to study history, which is another thing we was trying to carry on, you know.
Yeah. There never was any.
They're good musicians. They play fiddle, banjo, mandolin, guitar, bouzouki, tin whistle,
hammer dulcimer,
concertina. Highland pipes, Northumbrian small pipes.
Illan pipes.
Illan, set of Irish Illan. And
this is one band now.
You know, of course they've lost two of their good members.
Yeah, but they're
one
still
one girl got married. A lot of vocal stuff, you know. But it's nothing, the point is it's nothing modern. It's all old and either Appalachian or something prior
or
to
or
it.
Or British
roots.
Isles music.
Yeah, some kind of a descendant.
Now, the thing that made this whole thing interesting, too, the young people was. We did not, Frank, when I taught them a dance, and Frank accompanied it, we told them about it, where it came from, and things like that. We connected it with something. And their families, they studied family histories, and they studied all kinds of historical things. It wasn't just learning a skill. And I think that's why the kids in this state have learned and have been as interested in heritage things as they have.
There's too much emphasis on twirling and cheerleading and ball games and all. We took the other route.
Would you describe yourself as a self-educated person? I mean, it's obvious that, you know, despite your formal education, you've read a lot.
I'd say my schooling might be 5% of it. I don't know. I don't remember ever learning anything beyond back of college, except maybe some basic, you know, reading, writing, spelling. Or not sure I learned much of that.
So what? So most of your education has been on your own, right?
I'd say so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Why was this important to you? Why is it important for you to read a lot and to learn a lot?
I don't know. I'm just curious.
What subjects particularly interest you? I mean, where have you done? What areas have you done most?
History, music, firearms, musical instruments, ethnology, geography, language,
environmental things.
Yeah, biology.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be my pet subjects. That's far too many to handle.
do they all fit together in some way? I mean,
sure. You get shooting a flintlock rifle and you start to find out what the guy wore in the Revolution or before the Revolution. You get shooting a musket, you find out what the Yank dressed in and what the Rib dressed with. You find out where he lived and the counties of the state and when the state formed, when the counties formed, and dates and who family, who the early settler was, and maybe where they're from. And same thing with firearms. It all leads back to one thing. Whether it's music or firearms, it would lead you into history and culture and geography and philosophy and
so this is what you try to give the people you teach. You try to give them not just the tune, but
try to get that damn thing to working a little bit.
They've
got one, you see, but just use it.
I want to make a comment about when you asked him what he aimed to do in teaching people. There was somebody who came up to Frank at Pipestem State Park one year when we lived in Mercer County and made a statement, and I can't quote it, I wish I could, but it was something like people that know or have any skills should be sure that they give this skill to someone else or give themselves away, it was the phrase. And Frank looked at me and he said, there's not much of me left, is there? And that was true, and because you see, he had access to West Virginia youth all over this state through the Extension Service, which I worked for, because we worked together with the youth programs. He helped me.
Mm-hmm.
And West Virginia youth they've heard the bagpipes, and they've heard the old Philippines, and they've seen the not only square dancing and flatfoot stuff, but the back to the British Isles and the roots of it.
If you don't give the youth something to work with, you're liable to lose them. That's the point.
We built a lot of leadership.
That's sort of hitting a nutshell, I think. I don't know.
And he was doing it before I met him, but really, I think Frank met the young people of West Virginia because I introduced him to them. Wouldn't you say so?
Probably. I'd still be down there in the cave, I suppose.
They'd still be having to find him.
He'd have to be coming down to see the old guru. They'd say, why are you so calm and sedate? And I'd say, it's the rum to do that.
is it possible to put any kind of label on your fiddle style? As you say, you've got a sort of a mix of influences. How would you describe it?
Some would call it old time, some would call it traditional, some would call it Appalachian.
What's the difference between all of those?
I don't know there is any difference.
What is it people say about you?
Tradition is something that comes down.
Purist. He's a
comes
purist.
Down from one generation to the other, whether it's family or neighbor or friend, and it's not polluted by cylinder records, radio, TV, or the traveling circus. You know, read past Chautauqua or the carnival and circus, steam calliope and all that.
But did you listen to the radio? I mean, did you listen to records? Mm-hmm.
But you did listen to the radio.
Listened to the radio, and when the country, the so-called country music, hillbilly came on, or the orchestras, off it went. I turned it off. Nobody turned it off for me. I turned it off.
Well, why did, why did you do that?
Didn't like it. It was a terrible sound to me. I followed what sounded good and cut off what didn't sound good.
But you would still say that the influences on you were the people you learned the tunes from, not influences from radio. Or
definitely.
But you
I'm the link. See, I'm the link with the past.
One thing his mother said that I'll never forget, and this was the first thing, probably didn't have anything to do with him except to point out what was there. She said that he listened to the radio when he was a little tiny thing, you know. And then when he was 4 years old, he crawled up on the piano stool and played a tune. Mm-hmm. And that was what he'd heard on radio. And that was just because he could do it, I suppose.
Monkey see, monkey do. Monkey hear, monkey do.
I think that's kind of astonishing. So that showed her then that he, and his dad too, his dad took him everywhere. He tells me how he used to go where anybody was playing music on the weekend, his dad would put him up on his shoulders and away they'd go.
If it was the right kind of
tradition,
music.
The old time stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he used to carry me on his shoulders over to all the hills to dance it.
Is it more difficult for young people today to remain immune from some of those influences that you were able to turn off to remain?
Oh, yeah. My God, the television goes on the first thing you get up in the morning. And what do you hear? Buck Owens. Who's that clown with all the sequins and all? Porter Wagner. Mm-hmm. What kind of stuff is that for the youth?
What do you do about that? I mean, how do you keep them a little closer?
You can't.
Let me tell you.
They don't know the difference.
A brief story. There's a kid here in the fiddle workshop, in Ian Kennedy's fiddle workshop, a little tiny blonde girl. Now, Frank knew her dad. Her dad used to hang around him, go to every festival, and just doggy footsteps. And they grew up, Becky and Scott Rogers, and had two little girls. And that child can play a fiddle, and she's what, seven?
Seven. Plays pretty good, too.
And we went to visit their home, and they're the most cooperative, nicest kids I've ever seen. That young couple's raised two daughters, and both of them have this perfectly wonderful attitude toward people and about themselves and what they're doing. And I said, you are doing a darn good job raising these kids. And Becky said, look around. I said, wonder how you're succeeding so well, and other people try and don't. She said, look around. And then it didn't dawn on me. Somebody said, you don't see any television here, do you? And it's true.
Yeah.
So it can be done. And I think, Frank, I think that kid is directly responsible back to him because his dad and mother, grew up in Mercer County, and Scott was so interested in the things, that not just the music, the history and all, the whole ball.
TV's one of the worst things that's happened. It forces this stuff. It's repetition, you see. Addison Avenue, for day and night. It's unbelievable. It could be a great thing. It could be a marvelous thing, an educational instrument, see?
Some of it is.
Going the other way. Well, there's a little bit, Grant, on public TV. Special program, National Geographic. Some of that that's informative, but my God, the violence and the so-called music and damn soap operas and all this stuff that's going on right down in the next part of the neighborhood right here on TV, just different characters, I don't know why people watch it. All you gotta do is get some binoculars or watch your own family.
Just getting back to the music again. You're in a situation where you've got to fight against this sort of mass culture, which includes television. How do you get more people interested? What do you think you've got left to do to encourage more people?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a tough one. You come to things like this for one, and work with people who've finally seen the light on what music is.
People write a book. Frank won't do that.
I mean, we'll always have somebody that's going to make somebody going to play rock and roll, and they're going to be built up. You see, all this stuff is public relations. You see, this is promotion. And it's not very good. I wouldn't mind promoting something that's good. I mean, that's the thing, you see. But I'm not gonna promote that kind of rot. It's a quality thing, and you know, you got to try to make people see the difference. Quality or trash. You got a choice.
Now you're currently a member of the Big Possum String Band, right?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that and when that came together.
Well, it was Larry's idea, I think.
Sure was. Mm-hmm.
About 2 years ago.
Oh, not that long.
Maybe less than 2 years. We went over to Harvey's in October of 84 and got to playing a little bit, but Charlie wasn't with us. Jimmy Cost was playing guitar.
Jimmy Cost was along. And then after that, well, Larry was already interested in Harvey. I don't know whether he got interested in him at the Jubilee or where, but Harvey had been neglected.
The point was that Harvey had been sort of put aside, and he was kind of, what do you call him, Phoebe's side man.
He was neglected among the old unique fiddlers.
And of course, to most people, Harvey's just another hick who can't play a fiddle, you say. That's because they don't understand what he's doing. I don't expect non-musicians to know what we're doing, you say. I can't help that. So Larry said, let's get us a little band together. Harvey's never been in anything like that, and he's getting old. And Harvey went for it, you know. He said, yeah, I said, we could be kind of like a bunch.
That's great.
And, so they were playing somewhere one time, and old man Mollahan said, they wanted him to say something about, why don't you play, you know, and he was hesitant. He says, no, I said, Big Possums don't come out till late at night. So that stuck with somebody's mind, Larry or somebody, but I don't think it was Larry had that idea, was it?
Well, we were talking about
it. But anyway, that was the cause, the direct cause of this name, Big Possum. That was the reason for the name of the band.
We were discussing it when it came out, you see, that Harvey, it was late for Harvey. I said, well, how?
Late at night, late in his life, and things like that.
Big Possum's.
So that was the reason for it. And then, of course, the record was the outcome of this effort here because we didn't have any way to finance it. The record costs, what, $3,500?
Well, not that much, I don't think, but an awful lot.
So he approached these people here who had made two or three, I guess. And you know the rest of that story.
I know the rest of the story. Now, is this, have you on a regular basis then, played with another group of musicians? I mean, the impression I've got is that you've played with somebody and somebody else. It's been sort of really...
Yeah, I've never been a member of a band.
Yeah. Okay.
We had a little band in Bluefield. Didn't even have a name, played for dances. And this one would be the only ones.
Frank plays with pickup bands, and they may play together for 6 months or a year occasionally, like when you go to Vandalia Gathering or when you go to Denver, you get together and play.
Well,
Cedar Point was a band.
Short-lived one.
And the Southern Cash Pipe Band was a little
band. Oh, I forgot about that. We keep going and have a dozen or two.
What's the difference then between sort of playing in the pickup bands, as Jane describes, and maybe playing on a little bit more of a regular basis with the same people, developing something or a repertoire? Is that better for you to do it that way? Or?
Well, it'd be better, but the point is these local bands like Cedar Point or something can't stay together. David went off to college, you see, so there's no more Cedar Point for a while anyway. And the Erdfurkel, they've lost two members. One had to go to Huntington to teach or something. No, he's still in it, isn't he? No, well, Nancy got married and moved away. They lost it.
They were separated by space is the main problem.
Yeah, distance, you know. They go to school or they go to work, and they can't stay right here like a band ought to be. That's the reason some of the greatest pipe bands in the world are in Scotland, and they're known as, for instance, the Bow Hill Colliery.
Somebody sponsored
District
them.
Pipe Band.
They're all together.
These are miners. They practice every night or whenever the shift's over. Mm-hmm. The Invergordon Distillery Pipe Band. They're all right here, and they can work at it, and they become champions.
But that isn't the reason you haven't belonged to a band, is it?
Not necessarily.
The reason you haven't belonged to a band, if I understand, is because you don't like to travel and have the hassle of going from one place to the other and carrying instruments.
I don't like to travel with instruments and have to live in hotels or in the van and eat restaurant food and put up with drunks and dope and dogs and naked women and naked children.
Is it really as bad as that?
Now, he has had lots of opportunities and, in fact, been begged to go with bands and the tour, and he hasn't done it. Since I've known him.
That's not the way to go.
Are you playing more fiddle and banjo these days, or more banjo than fiddle, or is it sort of...
I'm playing mostly fiddle at the present. And I don't really get much practice because of David moving away. About the only people I play with now is Larry and Harvey and Charlie.
Always it has been, wherever we've lived. You know, we get acquainted with the musicians in that locality, and then for a little while, that's your group. So now it's the Big Possums. And who knows how long they'll last. No, they've lasted a little while.
It'll last a year or two.
Year and a half, maybe. And they haven't played, they haven't been on tour or anything like that. They just play together when there is a request.
Yeah. The idea of the record is mainly to get some of those odd tunes of Harvey's down, you know, before he's gone. Because these old timers are kicking off.
Now,
he'll be gone.
Obviously you're learning some tunes from Harvey now, are you?
Yeah, I've learned a few. And remembered some, like that the Train on the Mountain. I knew it was Train on the Island years ago, you know. Remember.
Yeah, anybody ever remembers the titles, because some of them have 6 or 10 titles.
And some don't have any.
You mentioned a couple of the early influences. Other people of Harvey's age who, you know, over the years you've worked with on a reasonably regular basis, you know, people, you know, whose houses you've gone out to?
Like, for instance, he's asking you, was Cedar Point similar to Big Possum?
Well, no, I wasn't really asking that. I was asking, you know, obviously as the years go on, you know, your repertoire has increased, you know,
always picking up tunes.
So are you picking them up from sort of other people your age or younger musicians or older musicians?
Not much, no. Well, may learn one at a thing like this from Jerry Mellons or something, but mostly from older folks who are still left. Of course, I've learned quite a few tunes off of old 78 RPMs, but if I am in a class and I play something like Drowsy Maggie, I make it very plain and very forceful that I got this off a record. This is an Irish tune, and this is not Appalachian music, and I did not learn it from somebody at home or in the community, you say.
The truth of the matter is that there isn't very many tunes that Frank can't recall. There's not many that are new to him, because I remember one time when we lived at the apartment, that was in the early 70s, and he got up one morning and he said, I thought of a tune last night that I haven't played for 20-some years, and he's been playing it ever since. And see, this was probably from Jim Farthing.
They come and go. There's so many of them.
Things.
You get boggled and you can't recall, you know, just any time.
There's not many you can fool him with, so.
You have to hear, I usually have to hear something that reminds me of something, you say, to recall.
And you usually remember where you...
Once I remember that tune, I can tell you where it came from. You know, I got a pretty good memory, except I can't remember anything.
You've lost your house key.
Yeah.
And that
well, that's a different
gun.
Thing. I misplaced things. I put stuff away real
he
good.
He hides
never
it from himself.
It
but you remember the important things.
Mm-hmm. Who played that tune and where?
Mm-mm. Now, that house key is awfully important.
Anyway, it's been an interesting little
I've enjoyed talking
little phase.
Well, I think you've probably
I was probably born 100 years too late.
But told you him in banjo
since
workshop.
You don't have anything to do with that, you just have to make the best of it.
Told him in the banjo workshop this afternoon he'd like to have been born. Somebody asked him that. Do you feel like, you know, one of the records is anachronistic, mm-hmm. and you know the meaning of that. So somebody said, do you feel like you were out of time? And he said, yes, I'd like to have been born 100 years early and fought with Stonewall Jackson. And then somebody said, well, do you think it would come out different if you had? And he said, yeah, probably.
Who knows? Gettysburg might have been turned around.
Yeah.